You should have let me poison the irrigation channels, Nefa said flatly as they watched from the other side of the valley. You know better than that, Taita shook his silver head. That would have been an offence that the gods would never forgive. In this bitter land only Seth or Sueth could contemplate such a foul deed. On this day I could play Seth willingly enough. Nefer smiled bleakly, but he said it merely to provoke the Magus. Your two rogues have done well. He glanced at the two ragged Bedouin who knelt beside Taita. Pay them and let them go. They place no value on gold, Taita explained. When I lived at Jebel Nagara, they brought their children to me, and I cured them of the yellow flowers. He made a sign of blessing over the crouching men, and said a few words to them in their dialect, thanking them for risking their lives to mislead Trok, and promising them his future protection. They kissed his feet, then slipped away among the boulders. Taita and Nefer gave their full attention to the unfolding battle in the valley below. Trok's men and horses had drunk until their bellies bulged, and now they were mounting. Even though he'd lost so many chariots on the approach march, Trok still outnumbered Nefer's forces at least 3-1. We dare not meet him on open ground, Nefer mused, and looked down upon the mass of refugees escaping up the valley below them. To begin with, there'd been very few women in the city. Nefer had deliberately kept their numbers down to eke out the reserves of food for his fighting men. And even they, including Mintaka and Merikara, together with all the children, the sick and wounded, had been evacuated from Galala 2 days before. Meron had gone on one of the wagons carrying the contents of the treasury, the gold they'd lifted from the false pharaohs. Nefer had sent them all to Jebel Nagara, where Trok would never find them, and the tiny spring of water would just support them until the battle was decided. Now Galala was stripped of everything of value, every chariot, weapon, and piece of armour. He gazed down on the refugees with satisfaction. Even from this close it was difficult to tell that they were not women and civilians, but disguised foot soldiers. Many of these stalwarts were tripping and stumbling in their long skirts and shawls. The bundles they carried in their arms were not swaddled infants, but their bows and swords wrapped in shawls. Their long lances had been cached among the rocks higher up the valley, where his main force was concealed. All Trok's chariots had finished watering, and they were coming on across the pastures in tight and ordered formations, wave after wave of fighting vehicles. The water had revived them miraculously, and before them lay the promise of plunder and rapine. "Pray, Horus, that we can entice Trok to take up the pursuit and enter the valley," Nefer whispered. "If he does not take the bait and seizes the undefended city instead, then he denies us water and grazing. We'd be forced to come to battle in the open ground where he'd have every advantage." Taita said nothing. He stood with the golden periap pressed to his lips and his eyes turned upward in the attitude that Nefer had come to know so well. The enemy were close enough now for Nefer to be able to pick out Trok's chariot among the moving mass of vehicles, as it wheeled into a position across the mouth of the valley, crowded with the fleeing refugees. Trok was in the centre of the leading rank, 10 of his chariots on each of his flanks, on a front wide enough to sweep the valley from side to side. Behind him the rest of his chariots were formed up. The dust settled round them, and a terrible silence fell over them. The only sound was the faint babble and hubbub of the fleeing rabble in the gut of the narrow valley ahead of them. "Come, Trok-Uruk," Nefer whispered. "Order the charge! Ride into history!" In the leading chariot in the front rank of the massed forces, Ishtar the Mede crouched beside Trok's massive armoured figure. He was so agitated that he reached up to tug at the ribbons of Trok's beard. "The smell of the warlock hangs in the air like the reek of a 10-day-old corpse." His voice was shrill and saliva frothed on his lips and flew in a cloud with the force of his emotion. "He waits for you up there like a man-eating beast. I can feel his presence. Look up, mighty Pharaoh." Trock was distracted enough to glance up at the sky. The vultures had dropped lower.
Yes, yes!
Ishtar pressed the small advantage.
The Ataita's chickens, they wait for him to feed them your flesh.
Trock looked back up the valley at the prize that lay before him, but the shadows of the vultures flitted over the earth between them, and he hesitated. Hidden among the boulders on the steep side of the valley, Nefer watched him. He was so close now that Nefer fancied he could read his expression.
"Forward, Trock," Nefer murmured. "Sound a charge. Lead your army into the valley."
He could sense doubt in the manner that Trock fiddled with the reins in his hands and turned his head to look down at the skinny figure of Ishtar beside him. The Mede's blue-painted face was turned up to him earnestly, and he touched Trock and tugged at his armour with the force of his entreaties.
"It is a snare laid for you by the warlock. If you never trust me again, you must trust me now. There is death in the air and the stench of treachery. I can feel Taita's spells like bat's wings beating against my face."
Trock scratched his head and glanced over his shoulder at the ranks of chariots parked wheel to wheel and his troopers leaning forward in cruel anticipation of his order.
"Turn aside, mighty Trock. Seize the city and the water fountain. Nefertiti and the warlock will perish out here in the desert, as we so nearly did. That way is certain. The other way is madness."
On the hillside, Nefer narrowed his eyes as he watched his disguised troopers scurrying away up the valley, and he knew that the moment was passing.
"What is holding Trock? Will he not commit to the charge?"
Nefer cried aloud.
"If he does not charge now..."
"Look to the head of the valley." Taita had not opened his eyes. Even in his agitation, Nefer glanced up the valley and stiffened with alarm. His fist tightened on the hilt of his sword until the knuckles turned white as bone.
"It is not possible," he growled.
Near the top end of the valley, but fully visible from where Trock's chariots were drawn up, was a slab of rock. Square and ochre-coloured, it stood like a man-made monument beside the road. On top of this, above the stream of fleeing refugees, had appeared a single figure. It was a woman, young and slim, with long dark hair that hung to her waist. Her chiton was the crimson of the royal house of Apepi. It stood out brilliantly, a speck of colour in the bleakness of bare rock and sand.
"Mintaka,"
Nefer breathed.
"I ordered her to go with Merin and Merikara to Jebel Nagara."
"We know that she would never have disobeyed you." Taita opened his eyes and smiled ironically. "Therefore it seems she must have misheard you." "This is your doing," Nefer said bitterly.
"You're using her as bait for Trock. You've placed her in mortal danger."
"Perhaps I can control the Khamsin," Taita said. "But not even I can control Mintaka Apepe. What she does of her own free will." Beside them, Trock had turned to give the order of his chariots to wheel away, to let the rabble escape, and to seize the fountain and the city of Galala as Ishtar was urging him. Before he could speak, he felt Ishtar stiffen beside him and heard him whisper,
"This is something that Taita has conjured."
Trock jerked round and stared up the long rising valley. He saw the tiny figure in the crimson dress standing high on the yellow rock platform. He recognized in an instant the object of all his hatred and rage.
"Mintaka Pepe," he snarled. "I have come for you, you adulterous little dog bitch. I will make you plead for death."
"It is an illusion, Pharaoh. Don't let the warlock deceive you."
"That is no illusion," Trock said grimly. "I will prove it to you when I bury my prong in her warm flesh and prod her until she bleeds."
"The warlock has blinded you,"
Ishtar howled.
"There is death all around us."
He tried to leap down from the footplate and run, but Trok seized him by his lacquered locks and hauled him back.
Nay, stay with me, Ishtar the Mede. I will let you have a taste of her sweet crevice before I throw her to my bully boys to finish off.
He raised his clenched fist high above his head and shouted,
"Forward! March!"
The chariots on either hand rolled forward together, and the ranks behind followed Trok into the valley, the sun sparkling on the javelin heads, and the dust rose around them like smoke. The tail of the fleeing refugees was 300 paces ahead when Trok gave his next order.
"Forward at the gallop! Charge!"
The horses leapt away, and in a rising thunder of hooves and wheels they swept up the narrow valley.
"Trok has committed," Nefer said softly. "But at what cost? If he takes Mintaka—"
He could not bring himself to go on, but he stared in anguish at her tall, lithe figure standing serenely in the path of the storm. "Now you have something to fight for," Taita said gently. Taita felt all his love and deadly concern for Mintaka become battle rage, but it was a cold, hard rage that sharpened every one of his senses and filled his being to the exclusion of all else. As the phalanx of chariots swept by below where he stood on the side of the valley, he stepped from behind the rock that had concealed him. The complete attention of Trok and his troopers was fixed on the helpless victims ahead of their racing chariots. They had no eyes for the tall figure that suddenly appeared high on their flank. But all Nefer's men could see him clearly. They were hidden among the boulders down both slopes of the valley. Nefer raised his sword above his head, and as the last chariot sped past, he brought it down sharply. The wagons were poised on the steep gradient, with their wheels chocked and lashed to hold them. They were screened from view with dried grass, the exact colour of their surroundings, and they were so heavily laden with rocks that the axles sagged. At Nefer's signal, his wagoners pulled out the wooden chocks and slashed away the lashings that held the wheels. From both sides of the valley, the wagons rolled forward, gathering speed, bounding down on top of the massed chariots below. When Ishtar screamed at his side, Trok tore his eyes from Mintaka's figure at the far end of the valley. He saw the huge vehicles tearing down upon his squadrons. "Back!" he shouted. "Break away!" But even his bull voice was lost in the uproar. The charge, once launched, could not be stopped, and there was no space to maneuver in the narrow floor of the valley. The first wagons crashed into the head of the charge. There was the rending of wood, the screams of crushed men and horses, the thunder of wagons overturning and capsizing, shedding their loads of rock. Suddenly the way ahead of Trok was blocked by one of the cumbersome carts, and his horses swerved into the chariot running beside him. In an instant, the magnificent charge was transformed into a shambles of shattered and overturned vehicles and crippled horses. The wagons had sealed off the valley at both ends. Even the chariots that had not been smashed and capsized were now bottled up in a struggling mass. The whole purpose of the chariot, its strength and threat, was its ability to run and turn, to charge and pull back at speed. Now they were immobilized, held by walls of stone, and Nefer's archers were on the slopes above them. The first volleys decimated the unprotected charioteers. Within minutes, the valley was transformed into a slaughterhouse. Some of Trok's men jumped down from their trapped vehicles and charged up the sides of the valley on foot, but they were exhausted by the grueling approach march and burdened by their armor. The ground was steep and rugged, and they moved only slowly. From the cover of the boulders and walls of hastily erected stone zarebas, Nefer's men met them with long lances and hails of javelins. Most were cut down before they reached the first rank of the defenders. Trok looked about him wildly, seeking some way out of the trap, but one of his horses was dead, crushed by the spilled load of rocks from the wagon that blocked his way forward. Behind him the other vehicles were so crowded that there was no room for him to turn or back up. Arrows and javelins were singing round him, clattering against the sides of his chariot, clanging off his helmet and breastplate. Before Trok could restrain him, Ishtar took advantage of the confusion to spring down from the footplate and scuttle away between the wrecked chariots and plunging, shrilling horses. Then Trok looked ahead again, and incredulously he saw Mintaka still standing unmoved on the top of the ochre rock pile just ahead of him. She was staring at him with a cold look of revulsion on her lovely face that turned his rage to madness. He snatched up his war bow from the rack at his side and reached for an arrow from the quiver. But then he changed his mind, threw the weapon aside, and shouted at her over the heads of his rearing and plunging horses,
"No! An arrow is too good for the bitch in heat! I'm coming to get you with my bare hands! I want to feel you struggling as I squeeze the last breath out of it, you filthy little harlot!"
He drew his sword and sprang down to the ground. He ran forward under the hoofs of his rearing horse and scrambled over the overturned body of the wagon. Two of Nefer's men jumped up from behind the rocks to oppose him, but he hacked them down and ran over their twitching corpses. His eyes were fastened hungrily on the girl in the crimson dress, standing tall and proud ahead of him, the flame to his moth. Nefer saw Trok break out of the trap, and he ran down the slope, springing from rock to rock.
"Run, Mintaka! Get away from him!"
he shouted urgently. But either she did not hear him, or she would not listen. Trok did hear him, and he stopped and looked up.
"Come on, then, my pretty boy. I'll have enough blade for both you and your whore."
Without breaking his run, Nefer hurled the javelin in his hand, but Trok caught it neatly in the centre of the light targe he carried on his shoulder, and the weapon spun away, clattering on the rock, and landed at Mintaka's feet. She ignored it. The throw had been enough to divert Trok for the moment, and Nefer sprang down onto the level ground in front of him. Trok went on guard as Nefer confronted him, and then his face twisted into a ferocious grin. He crouched behind the bronze shield and waved the sword in his right hand.
"Come, puppy," he said. "Let's test your claim to the double crown."
Nefer used the impetus of his run down the slope and came at him without pause. Trok caught the first blow on the circle of bronze. Nefer jumped back just as Trok cut at him over the top of the targe. Nefer closed in again, trading thrust for cut. Nefer's men had seen him charge down the hillside. They followed his example, left the cover of the rocks, and came bounding down in waves. Within seconds, the full length of the valley was choked from side to side with struggling, hacking, thrusting men. Nefer feinted at Trok's hip, aiming at the joint of his armour. When Trok covered, he swung backhanded at his face. Trok was surprised by the change of direction and by the speed of the stroke. Though he jerked his head back, the point of Nefer's blade split his cheek open and the blood gushed into his beard. The wound galvanized him, and Trok roared and rushed at Nefer. He swung blows from every angle with such rapidity that his sword seemed to form an impenetrable wall of shining bronze around him. Nefer was forced to fall back before the attack until he felt the stone slab on which Mintaka stood pressing into his back. He could no longer retreat or maneuver, and he was forced to pit himself against all Trok's bull-like strength and trade him blow for blow. In a contest of this nature, there were few men who could stand against Trok, who never seemed to flag. And he laughed as Nefer managed to turn some of his blows.
"Let's see how long you can stem the tide, boy. I can go on like this all day, can you?"
he asked without missing a stroke. Metal clanged and rang on metal, while Trok moved gradually to the right, blocking the only way that Nefer might slip out of his clutches. Trok's strength was like some malignant force of nature. Nefer felt that he was caught in a great storm wind, as helpless as if he were carried away on the riptide of the ocean. As much as the years of battle training had hardened him, they had not prepared him for this. He felt his right arm tiring and slowing as he tried to match Trok. Trok nicked the side of his neck, and then seconds later sliced open his leather corselet and scored him along the ribs. Nefer knew that his only chance of surviving the storm was to trade his speed and agility against Trok's brute strength. But he was pinned against the rock. He had to break away. He caught the next cut high on his blade and deflected it just sufficiently to make an opening through which he could escape. But as he leapt into it, he exposed his left flank. Trok recovered and drove in a low thrust that laid open his thigh just above the tattooed cartouche. The blood ran down into his sandal and squelched at every pace he took. The last of Nefer's strength was ebbing away, and Trok swept up his blade and locked it with his own, forcing his guard higher and higher. Nefer knew that if he attempted to break away, he would expose his chest for the killing thrust. Yet the cut in his thigh had weakened and slowed him still further. The grin on Trok's face was triumphant.
"Courage, boy. It's nearly over. Then you can rest forever," he gloated.
Nefer heard Mintaka shout something, but it made no sense, and he could not afford the distraction. Gradually, Trok forced aside his blade and towered over him, so they came chest to chest. Then suddenly he shifted his weight to the left, towards Nefer's wounded leg. Nefer tried to counter, but his leg gave way under him. Trok hooked his foot behind Nefer's heel and threw him over backwards. The sword flew from Nefer's weakened grip, and as he sprawled on the sun-baked earth, Trok lifted his blade above his head with both hands for the killing stroke. He was poised like that when suddenly his expression changed to one of surprise and bewilderment. Without completing the blow, he reached up behind his own neck with one hand. He brought the hand back and held it up before his face. It was wet with his blood. He opened his mouth to say something, but a double stream of bright blood trickled from the corners of his mouth, and he turned slowly away from Nefer. Trok stared up at Mintaka, who stood on the pinnacle of the rock above him. With a detached feeling of disbelief, Nefer saw the shaft of the javelin sticking out of the back of Trok's neck. As she saw Nefer go down, Mintaka had snatched up the javelin that lay at her feet, the weapon that Nefer had thrown at the start of the engagement. She hurled it at Trok's back. The point took Trok beneath the rim of his bronze helmet and went in deeply, just missing the spinal column, but opening the carotid artery. Standing like a gargoyle with his mouth wide open, blood spewing out in a fountain, Trok dropped his sword and reached up. He seized Mintaka round the waist and dragged her screaming from her perch above him. He was trying to say something, but the sheets of blood pouring from his mouth drowned his voice. Mintaka screamed as he crushed her to his chest, and Nefer scrambled to his feet. He picked up Trok's sword from where he'd dropped it and limped up behind him. Mintaka's cries had given renewed strength to his sword arm. He sent his first thrust through the lacings of Trok's corselet deep into his back. Trok stiffened and dropped Mintaka. She scrambled away, and Nefer pulled out the blade and stabbed again. Swaying on his feet, Trok turned slowly to face him. He took a step towards Nefer, reaching out for him with bloody mailed hands. Nefer stabbed him in the throat, and Trok dropped to his knees, clutching at the blade. Nefer pulled it away, slicing deeply into Trok's fingers and palms, severing the sinews and nerves. Trok toppled forward on his face, and Nefer stabbed him through the lacing between his shoulder blades to his heart. He left the blade in him, and turned to Mintaka, who crouched in the shelter of the rock. She flew to him and clung to him with all her strength. Now that the danger was past, Mintaka lost all her icy control, and she was sobbing, barely coherently.
"I thought he was going to kill you, my love."
"He almost did. But for you," Nefer gasped, "I owe you a life."
"It was terrible," Mintaka quavered. "I thought he would never die."
"He was a god." Nefer tried to laugh, but it came out wrongly. "They take a little killing."
He became aware that the sounds of battle from further down the valley had changed. With his arms still around her, he turned to look back. Trok's men had seen their pharaoh cut down, and the fight had gone out of them. They were throwing down their weapons and wailing.
"Enough, enough! We yield! All praise to Pharaoh Nefer-Seti, the one true king!"
With the realization of victory, Nefer felt the last vestiges of strength flow out of his battered and bleeding body. He had just enough left to raise his voice and shout,
"Give them quarter! They are our brother Egyptians!"
Give them quarter! As Nefer slumped down, Taita materialized at his side and helped Mintaka lower him to the ground. While the two of them dressed his wounds and staunched the bleeding from the deep cut in his thigh, his officers came to report to Nefer. Nefer discounted his own injuries as he demanded to know who had survived the battle and who had been wounded and killed. With joy and thanks to Horus and the Red God, Nefer saw that his trusted captains, Hilto, Chabako, and Sokko, were among the men who crowded around him, exulting in the victory, proud of themselves and their men, filled with joy to see him alive. They made a litter of lances and carried him back down the valley to Galala. But it was a long journey, for Trok's captured officers and men crowded the roadside, kneeling unarmed and bareheaded to plead for his mercy, shouting repentance and remorse that they had ever taken arms against the true Pharaoh. 3 times before they reached the gates of the city, Nefer signalled for his litter to be lowered and allowed the captured centurions and captains to come forward and kiss his feet. "I spare you from the traitor's death you so richly deserve," he told them sternly. "But you are all reduced to the rank of sergeants of the Blue, and you must prove once more your duty and loyalty to the House of Tamosa." They praised him for his mercy, but Nefer frowned and shook his head when they addressed him as a god. "I am not one of the Pantheon, as the blasphemers Trok and Naja claim to be." But they would not be dissuaded and renewed their praises and entreaties, and his own men, led by his brother warriors of the Red Road, joined their voices to those of the defeated, begging him to declare his divinity. To distract them, Nefer issued his orders with a frowning mien. "The corpse of Trok Uruk, the false claimant to the double crown of this very Egypt, shall be burnt without ceremony here upon the battlefield, so that his soul shall wander through all eternity, seeking but never finding a home." They murmured with awe, for this was the most dreadful punishment that could be devised. "The other enemy dead are to be treated with all respect and allowed embalmment and a decent burial. The name of Trok Uruk shall be erased from every monument and building in the land, and the temple that he erected to himself at Avaris shall in his stead be dedicated to the winged Horus in memory of the victory that he gave us this day before the city of Galala." They shouted their approbation at this decree, and Nefer went on. "All the possessions of Trok Uruk, all his treasures and estates, his slaves and buildings, his warehouses and goods of whatsoever nature, shall be forfeited to the state. Send water wagons back along the road to Safaga with grooms and surgeons, to bring in all the horses, chariots, and men that Trok Uruk left along the way during his arrogant march on our capital here at Galala. If they repudiate the false pharaohs and swear allegiance to the House of Tamosa, the prisoners shall be pardoned and recruited into our armies." By the time he had given his last order and issued his last decree for that day, his voice was hoarse, he was pale and almost exhausted. As they carried him through the city gates, he asked Mintaka quietly, "Where is Taita? Has anybody seen the Magus?" But Taita had disappeared.